My name is Stuart Taylor, and this is the fifth session in the first week of our series on Francis. The first session, we kind of did an overview of Francis and looked at his life story. And the second, we looked at Francis in relation to the poor. The third session was Francis in relation to the church. The fourth was Francis and recovery of the feminine. And tonight we look at Francis in relation to human suffering. Our task in every session has been to use some perspective on Francis's biography as a springboard for theological reflection about what radical discipleship means in our time and place. I wanted to get a sense of how many of you is this the first session in this series that you? Okay. Well, I hope that this session will kind of be self-contained and won't assume too much of what's gone before. Next week, I could just mention, starting on Monday, we'll be doing a week of looking at Francis in relation to creation. And we'll be using Francis's, some of you are aware of his, the only poem he ever wrote was called Canticle to Brother Sun, Sister Moon, and so on. And so we'll be looking at each of that poem in depth trying to reconstruct a spirituality of solidarity with creation. So that's a little look forward. I want to bring two things to your attention. There are still some handouts that summarize a brief chronology of St. Francis' life. Those are available to anyone who would like that. We still have a number of copies left. And also, this book that has really been the inspiration for this series, St. Francis, A Model for Human Liberation, written by the Brazilian liberation theologian Leonardo Boff. And I have spent the last few months just kind of working through this a couple of times and trying to interpret this and explicate this for myself. And so a lot of the inspiration of this series comes from this book. And this is available in the bookstore if you'd like to get a copy. Well, the book is St. Francis. The author is Leonardo Boff, B-O-F-F. It's on that little center table as you walk in there. You'll see.
I'll have to get it at my own library when I'm going
okay.
Home.
All right. I guess Francis, as we've encountered again and again, is such an enigmatic character. He is full of paradoxes. Someone who, it's strange to me, that someone who experienced so much suffering in his life, some that was chosen and some that was not, could have been, of all the Christian saints, the one who is most characterized by joy, the presence of joy and gratitude. It's just one of the paradoxes of Francis's life. Before his conversion, he had shattering experiences with war, with being a prisoner of war in a dungeon, with an illness that wrecked his health as a result of his imprisonment, with disgrace as he came home and never really got it together as a warrior in the town of Assisi. He experienced public disgrace. And then as that vocation of the warrior knight collapsed in his own as a sense of identity, he experienced profound depression in his early years. And after his conversion, as a part of his order, Francis experienced an extreme austerity of lifestyle. He certainly was a nature mystic, but he was no romantic about nature. He lived too close to the elements to really be a romantic or a sentimental romantic about nature. He knew what it meant to live close to nature. We remember that at the moment of his conversion, when he symbolically stripped of all clothes and left Assisi, letting go of all security and protection of the town and of family and of class, he literally walked out into a winter's day with nothing but a hair shirt on. And he hardly ever had much more than that. He had his the famous Franciscan cloak, but nothing more than sandals. So they lived a very austere life, and in many, many ways the Franciscans were very vulnerable to nature and experienced a lot of pain because of their disciplines. Francis experienced severe trials throughout his life and temptations and inner conflict. One of the most vexing of these conflicts was with other brothers in the order. Francis believed that as the order of Franciscans grew and expanded to other countries, that the essence of the order was being compromised by new changes. And this deeply troubled him. It caused him severe depression at times. He also knew real illness. He actually, and this is almost a horrible story, he had an eye disease and was finally, in which he was going increasingly blind, and so that any kind of light was very painful for him. And he was finally convinced to seek out medical care. And the medical wisdom of that time was that what Francis needed was to have his temples cauterized with a hot iron. And so he submitted to this treatment, which was must have been excruciating, though he seemed to somehow come through it okay. He experienced moments of a physical breakdown, and he died a relatively young man. I don't know what the life expectancy was in that day, but he was like 43 or 45, and knew that death was coming long before it actually came. And then, of course, that which we really want to look at most closely, the kind of Francis that, the suffering in Francis's life that was chosen. The suffering that comes from his commitment to following Christ. We talked in previous sessions of it, there were three key texts from the New Testament that informed what Francis was about. One was the story of the rich young ruler. The second was the sending out of the apostles two by two, carrying nothing but a tunic and a walking staff and no money. And the third was, you who would come after me must take up your cross and follow me. That the text that invite us to the way of the cross. That was definitive gospel, at the center of the gospel for Francis. I want to focus in to lay out a little bit more information about Francis, particularly in this last aspect of his experience of suffering, and then to talk about some of the responses to suffering that, as we experience suffering in the Christian life. What are some of the resources that we have, and how does Francis, how is Francis a resource for the suffering that we experience, or the Franciscan way? And then I want us to take some time to just really talk about what has been our experience of suffering and what have we learned from that. So that's going to be kind of the flow of our hour. And I'll need to be very disciplined about how much time I take to lay this out. Many of you have heard the story of the stigmata of Francis receiving the wounds of Christ. I want to tell that story because I think it's a very important story in the life of Francis. Apparently there was a mountain, Mount Alvernia, that was several days' walk from the Franciscan community at San Damiano in Portiuncula. And this was a mountain that had been donated by a duke, a wealthy landowner, to the Franciscan order for their purposes, which were to take retreats and to experience periods of solitude and prayer on this mountainside. It was a very, very rough mountain. It was an uneven plateau covered with boulders and trees and caves. And from this mountainside, you could actually look and see, on a clear day, you could see the sea on one side of Italy, and on a very, very clear day, you could see sea on both sides of Italy. So that it was quite a breathtaking view, and you can still go to this place today. Francis and his brothers built little huts scattered about this mountainside, and often would spend long periods of prayer and solitude in these huts, these hermitages, or in caves. Francis actually had a little hut that he went to that was alongside of a cliff that could only be reached by a log that crossed a chasm. And he would go out and stay on this ledge and live in this little hut. And every day his beloved brother Leo, who was one of his closest confidants, would come and bring him a little bread and water and would say evening prayers with him. Only, though, if Brother Leo got the signal from Francis to cross the log and join him. At a certain point in Francis's retreat, a couple of weeks into that, Brother Leo was no longer getting the signal to come across, and so Francis had clearly gone into a time of complete isolation, a fast, and he was to later recount this time as a period of severe spiritual trial, and also physical pain, periods of physical pain, followed by intermittent periods of ecstasy and joy and comfort. After a long period of this time, during this time, the theme of this retreat for Francis is characterized in this prayer that he repeated over and over again during this time. And the language is, I think, it's somewhat familiar, but somewhat archaic or a different kind of language, but try to hear what Francis was, the intent of his retreat. O my Lord Jesus Christ, two graces do I beseech thee to grant me before I die. The first, that during my lifetime I may feel in my soul and in my body, so far as may be possible, the pain which thou, sweet Lord, didst suffer in the hour of the most of thy most bitter passion. And the second is that I may feel in my heart, so far as may be possible, that exceeding love whereby thou, the Son of God, wast enkindled to bear willingly such suffering for us. That was the prayer and the intent of Francis's retreat at the end, near the end of his life, to actually enter into the life and being of the crucified God. To enter in so completely, to surrender his life so completely to that God's own loving solidarity for all of humankind, and to internalize that completely. What happened was the stigmata. Francis saw a vision of a seraph, which is an old a supernatural winged creature that's referred to in the Old Testament, approaching him from across this abyss with a cross behind it. And as it flew to him, he experienced this bitter pain across his body that was then swallowed up in this incredible joy. And this was the stigmata. And Francis so completely entered into the being of the crucified God that he actually experienced in his body the wounds of Jesus on the cross. He had puncture wounds in his hands and his feet, and he had a incision in his side. Now, this sounds like the stuff of legends, easily to be dismissed. And I admit to you, in my first reading of Francis, I still have my questions, and I certainly had my doubts. But it does seem to me to be plausible that if because of something that happens to the body, the spirit is affected, if why isn't it then a two-way street? If something could happen in the spirit of a human being so profoundly and so with so much reality, could that not be then manifest in the body? The body and the spirit are, after all, the Bible teaches, a unity. And so the two are one. My point, then, is not to argue whether or not this happened. My point is to say that in our own experience of suffering, Francis is a companion and a teacher. And I want to talk about four aspects of suffering in the Christian life that I think Francis has something to teach us, and that I think we have something to teach one another. The first aspect is what is called in the Old Testament is lamentation. And this is the tradition in the prophets, particularly prophetic literature, and in the Psalms as well, certainly in the Old Testament, of bringing our pain before God and of being able to give voice to that, to act that out, naming our despair, not trying to stoically repress that or hold that in as some kind of Christian stoicism. And I think this is one of the tremendous insights of Hebrew faith and of the faith of the Old Testament, that it's not heroic to keep our pain to ourselves tight-lipped. That has very little to do with the Christian life. But the people of Israel there was a tradition, an accepted tradition, of bringing the pain and the plight of the people before their God in a real confidence that God would hear their cries. You read the Psalms over and you see time and time again this kind of faith that feels that this is very natural and very comfortable to bring to God our cries of pain. And yet I think that somehow Christianity today encourages the kind of the so-called virtue of holding it in, of grin and bear it. It's much better to keep it to yourself. I think in some ways it's almost unhealthy not to feel and express despair in the kind of world we live in. It's certainly unhealthy to repress that, those points of despair, and to push those down deeper and deeper into our experience. When we repress that pain, and push it down and leave it unacknowledged, it somehow has a way either of flashing back and hitting us from behind, or it manifests itself in our bodies. I mean, we walk around with our necks or muscles and backs are just holding all of this pain because we won't deal with it in terms of our expressing it or naming it. So naming our places of despair. Francis was one who Francis was not this saint who never felt torment or pain or despair. Francis was one who was able to cry. I mean, the brothers could often hear Francis in the forest weeping. Francis often went to Claire, his colleague and sister, who had a parallel order for women, the Sisters of Poor Claire, and turned to her for consolation and nurture and support. He experienced black moments of depression in which he could do nothing else but simply let that out. And so I think Francis is one who reminds us that the first thing that we as Christian people must do with pain, or can do with pain, is to share that, to utter that, to let that out, to lament to God. And I think somehow if we think our prayer life should not be, quote, quote, complaining, then we've got probably an idealistic vision of what the prayer life is. I think we really do need to bring our pain to God. The second aspect of suffering that I think Francis can help us with is what I would call embracing our finitude. You know, one of the things about turning 30 is that you start feeling a little of the creaks, and you don't bounce back from the hike up the mountain as quickly as you did. And you can say, and those of you in your 40s and your 50s and your 60s, say, well, you ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, just the whole aging process is a kind of a humbling thing that we really fight and struggle against. And there's a sense in which we do need to fight against that. We need to take care of ourselves. We need to nurture ourselves and get the most out of life. But there's a sense in which, and tell me if this is your experience, that we are fighting a battle that we don't need to fight, that there's something about being finite creatures and having limits that we need to get, we need to be reconciled to, we need to make peace with. The fact that I am this bag of bones here, that I am a creature, that I'm limited, that I'm finite, that I have to die, that I don't go on forever, that in 1953 I didn't exist, and at some point in the future, I'm not going to exist again. That I am a finite creature. That's something that's scary. Our finitude is threatening. It causes us great pain at times. But Francis is one who I think made his peace with that. He had a strange, kind of a comic name for his body. He called it his brother ass. And he was pretty severe with his brother ass at times, but I think he also made his peace with his poor old body. And I think that's an aspect of our suffering and our pain, just the fact that we're creatures and that we're limited and that we experience loss and separation. Another aspect of suffering in which Francis has been my teacher is that which I've kind of phrased befriending the shadow. You know, the shadow, how many of you have heard that phrase from psychology or Jung's psychology about, some of you are familiar with that concept, of the shadow side of the self is the parts of ourselves that we're not very comfortable with, that we'd rather kind of push around and sweep under the rug. The parts of ourselves that contradict our ideal version of us, who we'd like to think we are and who we'd like everybody else to think we are. That's the shadow self. The shadow self is often where our anger ends up living, where our secret fears are pushed aside and hidden, where all of our doubts about ourselves are often stuck. And Francis is a model for human liberation for me, because Francis did not deny this shadow side of his existence. He didn't push it down for some ideal of perfection like that we generally associate with saints, where he was just perfect in all of his thinking and doing and living. Francis was one that integrated all of the dark side. He integrated his fear. He integrated his rage. He integrated his ambition, his ambitions for life. He didn't push them aside or push them down. And I think there's a real important lesson in there, because so many of us tend in our Christian life to want to think of ourselves as this ideal. We have this ideal version of ourselves that we should be as Christians. And what we end up doing is distancing ourselves more and more from the rest of our experience. And that again comes around and boomerangs on us and constantly contradicts what we hope to be and want to become, because we don't greet that and integrate that and acknowledge it. In fact, there's some real important resources for us in that shadow side. Our anger, as threatening as it is not something inhuman. It's something that deserves to be a part of us, to find its place within us. Our ambition, you know, that's something, our pride, these are things that Christians have been taught to deny, to push down. Those are things that need to be integrated and transformed, not repressed. And I think Francis is a teacher for us in that. I want to share an image that came to me one time in a meditation. You remember, is it Psalm 23, the line from that psalm that says, "Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies." Did I get that right? Is that right? Okay. I had this flash of insight in a meditation in which I was wrestling with my shadow side, and I somehow imaged something like this, a round table in which Jesus invited all those parts of me that I found most objectionable, most unchristian, most unacceptable, and invited them to break bread at a round table. It was almost like Jesus prepared a table before me in the presence of all of my inner enemies. And we lined up around this table. And it was like I could greet and befriend all of these aspects of my interior life that I hated the most. It was like putting it on my table. Okay, on the table. All right, let's put our cards out here. Let's me and you talk. And it was almost like I had to take out my journal and start this dialogue of all these parts of myself that I had silenced and refused to listen to, because they all had so much to say. And once I started listening to them and going back and forth, they became less terrifying. And I began to see their true intention and their true form. They were parts of me that needed to be integrated to find their place within the whole the carnival that I am. I'm not just one person, I'm a lot of people. So I hope maybe that's an image or a way of getting at the kind of wholeness that radical discipleship calls us to, not exclusion or repression or even projection. You know, projecting what I can't see in myself, what I refuse to see in myself, onto somebody else. That's not the Christian way. That's not the way of radical discipleship. I think what Francis teaches us is that we need to include, to befriend, and to dialogue with these parts of ourselves that seem utterly like enemies to us. Would anybody want to say back or comment? Did that resonate with anyone?
Pick maybe the ones that are the most blatant examples, but you think of people who are sort of into some of the televangelists who've had problems. And you know what? The images of all this perfection, and then these things pop up, like sexual improprieties or this financial thing. And I think in some ways that's the kind of thing that maybe you're alluding to. I can remember my father, who was a pastor, used to say, he said, the worst unethical behavior will come from the people who are the most rigid in rules they put on themselves and others. Because it's like you just can't keep that corset on. And so I think in a way that's the reverse of what you're saying. But somehow if we sort of put this rigidity around ourselves and say this is the way we're going to live and refuse to deal with those elements, I think that's when we're in the most danger.
That's exactly right. And when a whole society does that, then you have this dangerous backlash of scapegoating one particular group that becomes the problem out there that they're unwilling to, that reminds that society of the problem in here that it can't deal with.
We're doing it right now in Iraq. They're the enemy, you know. I live here at Holden, so I just went out like for one night and I just could not believe it. I mean, the United States wants to go in, basically kick ass. That's what they're talking about. And it was so foreign to me. And they always talk about kind of inviting the enemy in, but no one's doing that right now. They're just kind of on the rampage.
I think we have to look at, when we hear the enemy rhetoric, we need to ask, either on an individual level, when I feel someone's threatening me, or I perceive them to be kind of an enemy or a threat, we need to look within, or I need to look within and see, okay, what is it that person is kicking up in me that I can't deal with about my own experience? And as a nation or as a community, when we start needing enemies or creating enemies, there's something unresolved within our own culture, within our own psyche as a nation. So that projection onto enemies. Yeah.
But that very same thing is true with our shadow. In chaplain's training, and I wrestled with this for quite a while, I had one chaplain who said that he thinks people who are constantly sick are angry as can be. He says that one of the ways they subterfuge everything. That another one said that he believes that some people who have arthritis get it because they're angry. They sit for so long with white knuckles that eventually their knuckles, they're stuck with it. I find in my parish, the people who are unable to deal with their anger are the problems. It's not only illness, but it's agitation and constantly. And if you call it their attention, I'm not angry, not me, somebody else, right away. I think there's a relationship with a lot of serious illness. People who have not dealt with their anger and their fears and can't can't change. You know, when somebody says they can't change, I just shudder. Good luck. You just get bound up.
That's a very, very important observation. I've had this dream that came to me once about my anger. I'm convinced now, where this female figure, and I have to think that was kind of an anima figure, or as we were talking about in the last session, took me down a stairwell into the basement of a house, and down in that basement were these gross scenes of monsters devouring people and all this blood and gore. And it was like a dream. When I woke up, I said, golly, I have got to deal with some of these feelings that have been rumbling around deep down below, of anger toward my parents, of anger toward my organization, the church, myself. I mean, it was this messenger in my dream life that said, you need to look and be attentive to these signals, these are exaggerated images for something that's going on deep inside. So, I want to allow us to kind of unpack some of this as a group together in discussion. I do want to mention one other thing, and this is the most important aspect of suffering that I think Francis can teach us about, and that is the taking up the cross. I think it's understandable, but perhaps incorrect when we hear folks talking about this or that vexation in life is the cross I have to bear, you know, the kind of the things that happen to us, and I've heard it, and you've heard it, someone saying, oh, that's just the cross he has to bear, the cross she has to bear. I think it's understandable that people would describe it that way, but I think it really is confusing to identify that kind of suffering with taking up the cross, because really taking up the cross is the suffering that we choose on behalf of others. It is a suffering that is inflicted on us when we join the struggle, God's struggle, to create a new society. When we throw the weight of our lives up against the systems that dehumanize and enslave our brothers and sisters, the least of these. And so, in some ways, this suffering can be the most severe of all, but yet it is an act of choice to pick it up. And frankly, I think we first world Christians in the U.S. we should be honest with ourselves and realizing and recognizing that there are not many of us who are followers of Jesus in the first world who have really taken up the cross. We have not ventured this far in the pilgrimage of faith to the point that we are actively struggling against the systems that enslave and murder millions upon millions of the world's citizens, of our fellow brothers and sisters in God. So this is a level of suffering that the church in the United States just doesn't know much about, I'm convinced. It's a level of suffering that we perhaps are not ready to move toward until we've dealt with some of these others, though in the third world they don't have the luxury of being, you know, psychically integrated and all of these things before they have to deal with this level of the cost of discipleship. It's thrust upon them and they choose it. They have to. But this is the most godlike suffering. That which is chosen on behalf of others, to enter into God's solidarity with the crucified of the world. And that's what I think Francis leads us in that. What I want to do now with the time that we have left is to draw on our own experience. First thing I'd like you to do is to simply look around the room and notice who's in this room. Just kind of notice some of the faces, the ones you've seen around and some of the new faces. And recognize that everyone in this room has been around, has experienced a lot of life. Everybody here is a veteran of many, many, many experiences of loss, of pain, of separation, of perhaps depression, of struggle. So there's a incredible resource of experience in this room and how we as human beings deal with suffering. And what I would like to do in the time we have left is to move a step beyond kind of the quote classroom in a kind of act of trust, that we really take some time to reflect in silence on some of those encounters with suffering that each of us know as we look within our own experience. To think about that, to name that, and to reflect on what that moment, that encounter, taught you. Now, if anybody is uncomfortable in going that extra step beyond the classroom, that's fine. You don't have to do anything or say anything that you don't want to do, and if you want to stay, you can, and if you want to leave, that's fine too. But I'd like to invite all of us to join in on that kind, that level of reflection if you're with me. Is that okay? Would everyone like to move forward with that? All right. Then let's take a few minutes, look within, and name that experience in your own life in which you have come face to face with some kind of suffering. Think about what that moment taught you.
I'm still wrestling with what I learned, but it was an interesting experience. I was in Nepal 2 years ago in a very remote community in western Nepal, and I had my period. And women are traditionally ostracized when they are menstruating. And knowing this, I grappled with what I was going to do, but because of my research and because I just didn't want to be ostracized in the dead of winter and out in the dung and straw hut, I faked it for a while or told them stories and they thought, oh, I was pregnant or something was wrong with me and I just didn't want to share my illness, but I said, the food had affected me, blah, blah, blah. I got away with it for a few weeks, a few months. And well, I found out and I was ostracized in the dead of winter and placed in a hut. And it was, known throughout the whole village and a lot of details that go along with this. But what happened while I was out in this hut was the pitted loneliness that I've been feeling by being the only Westerner. And I've often babbled to myself in the mountains and the fields, and I was just percolating within me, and I wasn't allowing it to come to the water. Rolling boil, as you said before, grinning and bearing it when I was feeling a lot of confusion and a lot of pain, and I lost it there. And the one woman whom I felt incredibly close to in this village, who had accepted me into the village, and when I entered it, they all thought I was affiliated with the CIA. How the heck did I speak this crazy language? Why did you learn our language? You speak it? How? You must want something from us, blah, blah, blah. And this one woman said, no. And she claimed to be Christian in a village of Hindus. Said, I'll take her in. She's here to learn. And I felt incredibly indebted to her. with my only contacts with Kathmandu, the capital of the Red Cross, and they came through of lucky, they were all Indians, educated Indians. Anyway, I lost it, and this one woman, Shivati, then lost it at me and became incredibly angry at me for crying and couldn't understand why I was crying. And she started babbling to me, you have no right to shed these tears. You have absolutely no right. You're going to walk out of here in a couple of months. You know, the Red Cross is going to, you know, see that you get on this little bit of donkey that's going to take you back to where you can get this small plane back to the village. You know, I should have said there have been a lot of deaths that winter in the family I was living with. Two of the children had died, and I found myself becoming really cold and becoming really frustrated with my anthropology training, because you rarely read about anthropologists falling apart. You know, ethnographies are always these Mother Teresa type people that just everything. Okay, or they can bear it, and they're totally altruistic, and I'm feeling deadened to everything around me. And trying to put closure on this, it's a weird one. I don't know that I have in my own mind, but what she taught me by leashing out at me and did reconcile the pain that I sort of bettered our friendship before I ended, to some extent, but it was never what it was. And she really held a grudge against me for being privileged. And I learned, I felt that I suffered, I was suffering, and I couldn't deny that. But by my suffering, I learned of their greater suffering and took that upon myself as a cross for quite some time after that experience, but recently. I'm trying to learn and trying to believe that there was some relativity to that, and that my suffering was indeed real. But at that point, and even looking back, not only being ostracized, but just being really lonely and misunderstood. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
It still doesn't make sense to me, but I learned a greater suffering exists, but I also feel like mine shouldn't be pushed under the carpet.
Yeah, I hear an awful lot in what you just offered us, that a lot of important stuff of experiences of where we have come apart in terms of our understanding of ourselves, that are somewhere in our past, painful encounters with reality of a harsh reality. And that we still haven't sorted them out, and we need to keep listening and being relating to those experiences, and trying to not shut them down and bury them, to come to terms with them. And I feel like there are moments in my own past where I was a different person than I thought I was. Something happened that I've discovered a different part of me, and I need to stay listening to that and talking to that. I also think the important thing that I heard in your story is this whole dichotomy between our suffering as first world privileged people and the suffering of this sea of suffering in the world that seems to make ours seem trivial. And I think the more sensitive we become to the suffering of the world, the temptation is to negate or deny the real pains that we feel as first world people. And I think that's a real temptation that people feel in the way of discipleship, that once they really begin to become conscious of the tribulation of the world, there's a counter reaction to say, what, my little struggles are not real, or God can't possibly know that, take this seriously, because it just doesn't matter compared to this. but I think it does. I think our struggle as first world people is in the heart of God, as is the pain of all people. It's just when we allow ourselves to be absorbed and paralyzed by that pain, when we stop dialoguing with it, that we can't enter into God's concern for the world, that we become really alone in that pain. So that's some of what I heard in your story, which just resonates with my own. Would someone else just offer, maybe it's not to say what I've learned, but what I'm trying to figure out, you know, from experiences I've had, what I'm seeking for. Maybe I phrased it into a complete or way. Would someone else offer a... Yes, sir.
I work in the environment of many, many homeless people in the downtown area of Seattle. And feelings that I experience take on a form of suffering as I can empathize with individuals and with a large population. But I come away from that, those experiences of empathizing with a lot of shame, a lot of embarrassment, and a lot of anger at myself and at government, at bureaucracy, at politicians, at the church. Those are the kind of feelings that I have very often. I don't have particularly colleagues with whom I share that, except for my wife and members of, let's say, my staff. But that's an experience of empathizing with those who suffer, and at the same time, suffering because of my own feelings, because I know that I am that rich young ruler. Because I've never known the feeling of being homeless, or being hungry, or being whatever that might be.
It's like we finally make this conversion and we're ready to move toward the poor, and the poor say, screw you. It's like our do-gooder gets rubbed, his face rubbed in his own excrement. That's I've experienced that a lot. I wanted my discipleship narrative to kind of proceed toward a glorious conclusion where I was leading the masses. I'm not putting this on you, but everything contradicted this ideal notion of myself as a servant of the people, ready to be out there on the cutting edge and saying the right thing and making the right decision and being there. And it was much more of a stumbling kind of gesture of and feeling a lot of the feelings you felt, you've expressed.
Along that same line, I was leading a group of students at a college I worked at through a homelessness experience in the middle of winter in the middle of Minnesota. And the goal was to increase awareness among the campus of the plight of the homeless, and we got wonderful press on this and everything else. And we stayed out for 48 hours in 10 to 20 below zero weather. And so it was really cold. It was heated with wood and everything. And we became homeless. And that feeling that we felt, people started to not look at us, people started to not pay any attention to us, and we were in the middle of a campus.
and we had built an actual shanty town. And it was the longer we were there, the stupider it became, because we knew that we weren't doing anything. I mean, we're poor little rich kids leading a homeless experience. The people that we tried to increase awareness just looked away. I mean, they paid a lot of attention to us at first, and then we got to be where we started to smell like wood smoke, and we hadn't washed, and we hadn't. And the only people whose awareness was really increased were the people who were there, and the people who actually had some sort of experience in that. And even in that, it was so minimal. And the thing that I found most amazing about the experience was that, not that we did it, but that we instantly became experts on what it was like to be homeless. I mean, you get numb. I mean, you get numb, and it doesn't matter. You don't really care. You don't care what you smell like. You don't care what you look like. You want to be warm. You want to eat food. You want to sleep. And it was just, but it was so minimal. I mean, it was like it was nothing, this, you know. And it was a belittling experience for us to do it. And after a while, the TV cameras would come and take pictures of us. And, you know, I had staff that actually said, get out of here. You know, there's homeless people underneath every bridge. Go down and cover them, you know. And it was just a really strange kind of feeling we got. It wasn't what we expected. Mm. We don't suffer very much.
Yes, sir.
Mine is personal. With my wife, when she was diagnosed as having cancer, and the doctor said it's going to be quiet for a while, and it's going to start getting bad, and it's going to be terminal, but he says 2 years. And during that 2 years, I became so relaxed that nobody would talk to me. I was the isolated one. But I think this is true. My wife and I both accepted the fact that she was going to die very quickly now, once we got over the shock. Now, when I say relaxed, I mean just what I'm saying. People would come in all concerned, and I'd say, well, what do you think we should do? You know, the doctor's taking care of it, and I'm sure the good Lord is involved.